Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Muskegon, Michigan, the 10th of 11 children. His mom died when he was 2.5, and his first jobs were washing cars and shining shoes. He went on to become the highest-ranking African-American in the history of the Big Three. He's the past president of the Boy Scouts of America and is now managing partner of a private equity firm. His name? Roy Roberts. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Roy Roberts, the highest ranking African American in the history of the Big Three. Roy, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
It's great to be here, Jack. You're doing a great job, and I love interfacing with you.
Can you start by telling about your childhood and your parents?
Well, my mother died when I was 2.5 years old, and I had 9 siblings. And my father moved from Arkansas to Muskegon, Michigan, when I was about 4 years old. So we were poor, and for me to say that any other way, I'd be overstating our economic condition. There were times when 3 or 4 of us would sleep in one bed. So it's one thing to talk about being poor. It's another thing to talk about love and the raising that we got and the nurturing from my father. He was a strong-willed person, and he made sure that we all believed in the right thing. He made sure that we all believed in education and that we were going to pursue it vigorously. So Muskegon was a good place for me to grow up. That's where I met my current wife, and so it served me very well.
How far did your dad go in school?
My father had a third grade education. He was from the South. He was a farmer. When he moved to Muskegon, he moved there because of the war, and they were hiring people during the war. So he became a foundry worker, and he was a part-time barber. And he was my barber until I was 18 years old and left home. Even though he didn't have a formal education, Jack, he had the best appreciation for education of anyone that I've met in my life.
How old were you when you first started to work?
Well, I started when I was about 15, maybe 14 years old, maybe 13 years old. Started out shining shoes at one of the local bus stations. And from that, I got a job washing cars in a service station. I did a number of odd kind of jobs. And then when I was between my junior and senior year, I did get a chance to sell clothes. And I really, really enjoyed that, and I thought it was less laborious than the prior jobs that I'd had.
A lot of our young people today don't want to take this job or this job because it's beneath them. What do you say to them?
I think that's a gross mistake, and I think some of the parents in this country have led some of the young people to believe that. We lead kids to believe that if you just don't have a degree and you aren't doing something with a white collar, it's not meaningful. I think meaningful work is honest work. It's honest work where people are willing to give a full day's work for a full day's pay. And then if you can work at that and work at some other things, you probably can move it on to another level. But we should never perceive work as being beneath any of us as long as it's honest.
Your mom passes at age 2.5, when you were 2.5. So you were raised by your dad.
I've met a lot of
people who didn't have a dad but had a mom. How do you explain that you guys have done so well just with a dad?
Well, there are two things. I have some sisters that are old enough to be a parent, and they were very, very helpful. It was a strong, close-knit family. By the same token, my father was the most principled human being I've ever met in my life, and he was very focused, and he was determined that each and every one of us were going to toe the line. Jack, I'd have to say if he did some of the things to me that he did years ago, I'd call 911 on him. But he was just resolute in terms of our growing up and respecting other people and having principles, and I really respect him for that.
10 of you got college degrees. How did you ever get the money to get these college degrees?
Well, we certainly didn't get it from him. My father worked two jobs to try to keep the family together. And but he always pushed education. He had the feeling and the notion that education is what turned dreams into reality. And he pushed all of us to go to school. He never paid one nickel, not because he didn't love us and didn't want to, but he didn't have the money. I didn't go to college until I was 22 years old. And I commuted from Grand Rapids, Michigan to Kalamazoo, Michigan for 6 years, working full-time raising a family. So it's not easy, but it's awfully important that people make it happen. And it's one of the most important things I've ever done in my life.
Talk about the importance of a college degree today.
Well, I think it goes beyond a college degree. But if you look at it retrospectively, there was a time you could come out of school here in the city of Detroit or any city where General Motors, Ford, or Chrysler had a plant, and you get a job with little or no formal education and earn a good living, a really good living. That day is over. Globalization have changed all of that. It's not going to happen anymore. So you've got to make sure that you develop skills. You've got to have skills to do something beyond just menial tasks that anybody could do walking down the street. So we have to encourage all of our young people to get an education. And as a matter of fact, Jack, I think that is one of the biggest problems in this country, and that's our educational system, kindergarten through 12th grade, which I think is one of the worst in any industrialized nation. But our college system is one of the best in the world, and we must do everything we can to get our kids educated.
There's many, many listeners out there, many people out there, 30, 35, 40, 45 years old, have been making a great living, and suddenly they're looking at the prospect of having to go back to school. They're petrified. What do you say to them, Roy?
Sure, they're petrified. I think you have to acknowledge that with them, along with them. But it's never too late to go to school. It's never too late to try and change your station in life. And maybe you aren't going out to get a PhD or an MBA, but it's a degree that will give you some marketable skills where you can do a job. And very importantly, it's important that you do a job and be able to eat. It's important that you feel good about who you are. And I think there's a lot to be said for that.
We're talking to Roy Roberts. When we come back, we'll ask him why, after 17 years with Lear Sigler, he quit and went to General Motors and took a pay cut. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Roy Roberts. Roy, you're with Lear Sigler. They think the world of you. You've got a great future there. And after 17 years, you leave, you go to General Motors for a pay cut. Why?
Well, Jack, I had a great time at Lear Sigler. I physically wrote the book on tuition reimbursement at Lear Sigler. I was the first person to go from zero credit hours to a degree. So there was a great love there, and I had a chance to really grow and learn a lot. I worked in every major functional area of that company. But General Motors came recruiting. And you know, that day and age, who would not want to work for General Motors? There was so much respect and so much admiration for the company that I was honored that they would approach me and try and entice me to join them. I interviewed with several people in the corporation. I found them to be very meaningful and very driven to want to make a difference. And I got excited about that. My wife and I talked it through, and we decided to do it. And my wife's a nurse educator, and she says, we'll chase your career. Because I really thought if I was doing anything meaningful in the company, I might get moved geographically, and I wanted to make sure we were suited for that. So I joined. I did take a pay cut, but I had this feeling that if I was really performing, I'd get that pay cut back. And ultimately, Jack, I did. I did get that pay cut back. Great company to be with, and I've enjoyed it immensely.
They set you up to run the Tarrytown, New York assembly plant. It just happened to be the worst assembly plant in the entire General Motors system. And you turned it around.
Well, how? Jack, it really might have been one of the worst automobile assembly plants in North America, bar any company, OEM. And I did not turn it around myself. We turned it around. I think that's really important, because there are too many people today who would singularly like to take credit for doing something when it's wrong. You can't do it with a whole lot of teamwork, a lot of people working together. We had a president of the UAW there. His name was Ray Calor. He and I collaborated and really worked on trying to make a difference in that operation. We did things like put a competitiveness center in the middle of the plant where our lower-level hourly and salaried people put up all the competitive data on our competition and what was going on in the marketplace and trained everybody in our plant to understand that. We'd bring the city council. We'd bring the county commissioners. We'd bring the school board through our operation about once every 5 weeks because we were the biggest employer in Westchester County. We made a big impact on that community, and we wanted them to know that this was their plant, and we wanted them to know how the quality was going, how the people relationship was going, and our people got prouder every time we did something like that, and it really started to make a difference. And we were able to turn around the quality, the cost, and the people relationship in that operation and got a new product allocated to the operation. And I've never been prouder of any undertaking in my life. But you've got to do it with other people. One of the newspapers, a local newspaper, national brand, wanted to name me Business Leader of the Year. And, Jack, I wouldn't receive it. I wouldn't accept that because I didn't do it by myself. So they made me and the president of the union co-business leaders of the year. And I think that's the way you have to do it. You got to share the success and all the problems. You got to accept all the responsibility for it. And that's been my motto in life. And I think I'll continue to do that until I die.
Then General Motors made you the Vice President of Personnel Administration and Development. What's that job?
Well, that's right. That was I had global responsibility for the personnel, the administration, development of all employees in General Motors globally. And they had an excess of 900,000 employees at the time. So you set policy. You set in terms of health care, in terms of number of holidays, promotions, how you move people, how you develop people, schools you might send them to get education beyond their basic education or grad degrees. All of that would come under the auspices of personnel administration development. A very awesome job. And also was responsible for having to oversee reducing our headcount by 40,000 people. And those are never the things that make you feel good, because what everybody would like to do is grow employment by 40 or 50,000 people. I'll never forget it. A new magazine that was on the scene at the time, and along with New York Times, they were interviewing me at the time. And they said, it looks like you might be known as a hatchet man. I said, well, that's not a fact. I'm really trying to right-size our company to make sure our human resources match up with the demands of the marketplace. And the term right-sizing that you hear today, I get credit, maybe wrongly, for coining that term during that time. But we did what we had to do, because if you have 10 employees and you have to lay two off to save the place for eight, then you have to be about doing that. Or you have to concede your responsibility to everyone else in the organization, the other eight people, the shareholders, and everyone else. And a responsible person will not do that.
The next job, they promote you to Group Vice President, whatever that means, of Sales and Marketing. There you had 9,000 employees, and you oversaw in excess of $100 billion enterprise.
Well, there are some jobs in between, and each and every one of them, I think any executive you talk to would say, every job I had I loved. I really did, because I had the opportunity to work with great people. I ran GMC Truck. We made that a division of GM, a very successful one. I ran Pontiac, and we made the decision at the corporate level to merge Pontiac and GMC at the distribution level. And then I took over as Group Vice President of Marketing Sales Service. And that's where you have the responsibility for all the marketing divisions in GM, and you have the responsibility for all the dealers and dealer relationships throughout North America. Major, major undertaking, because there are a lot of differences of opinion about what you ought to do, what you should be doing, and you're trying to get market share, which is so critically important to General Motors. Awesome undertaking, but I enjoyed it.
When you first started, the model was everybody's an employee. Everything's in-house. Now it's outsourced things, it's partnerships, it's alliances. Are there differences in working with people from when they're with different organizations, Roy?
Well, they're very different. Jack, there might even be two questions in your statement. Number one, you're right, it was all self-contained. At one time, when I joined the corporation, about 71% of General Motors was vertically integrated. Vertically integrated. Ford at the time, I think, was about 51% vertically integrated, and Chrysler might have been about 35% vertically integrated, where a Toyota was probably about 24 to 25% vertically integrated. If we were paying more money than the competition, there is the big differential, and I think that's where you see some of the outsourcing. And the globalization of what we're doing really drives the need for people to outsource and not keep that self-contained. We're not an island. It's a big global world, and there are people we're competing with today that we've never seen, we'll never see. They'll eat our breakfast, our lunch, and our dinner if we don't get that done.
We're talking to Roy Roberts. When we come back, we'll ask him about how he helped Buick in 1998 sign a young Tiger Woods to a long-term deal. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're with Roy Roberts. Roy, it's 1998, and Buick signs Tiger Woods. What role did you play?
Well, I think I played a very meaningful role. First of all, Buick really wanted Tiger, and they wanted that sponsorship. But the role I played that was so significant, Jack, I had the money, and I put the money up to sign Tiger, and Really, it was great foresight on the part of Buick to want him. In retrospect, though, if you ask me today where he should be signed by General Motors because he's a global figure and could represent General Motors around the world. This guy is absolutely a phenom, as we all know, and a really hardworking person that's really helped Buick. He's lowered the buying age of Buick buyers considerably. That might take you two models integration and sales to get that done.
Have you ever played golf with him?
Well, I have, and when we signed him, we had photo ops, and I was hitting balls with him, and they were taking pictures all over the place, and I hit my best drive about 265 yards, and he hit a four iron right over my ball, and I says, give me some advice, some counsel. What should I do? He said, you should slow down. I said, well, you don't slow down. He said, young man, you can't do what I do. And he's just a terrific person. Then he probably told me I should go and play tennis.
What do you most admire about him, Roy?
Well, his work ethic is absolutely incredible. But I think there's something that people miss. He is one of the brightest human beings that I have ever met, one of the most gracious human beings I've ever met, and he will work 12 hours for an eight-hour day. If he's under contract, if that's making a commercial, if that's interfacing with dealers, you name it, I have never met a more gracious and intelligent person.
Time after time, you've been a pathfinder. You've been the first African-American to do this, to do this, to do this. Where did you get the courage time after time to do it?
Well, I think it really go back to my father, who really instilled in all of us a sense of values that no political, social, or economic system could ever destroy. And he also taught us that you can't go through life just trying to be equal. If you do, at the end of the day, it was just equal. You've got to be better. You've got to go and work harder. You got to work. Nobody can outwork you. That's what you got to remember. You control that. They can be smarter than you. They can have a lot of things that you don't have. They can have a different pedigree than you. But you have the call and how hard you work. Jack, I've worked at it awfully hard. And the harder I've worked, the more people have tried to help me. I've had a lot of help from a lot of people. White people, black people, pink people, purple people, you name them, I've had help. And in the early days, I'll say something I probably wouldn't even have to say. Most of my mentors were white people because blacks had never gone there before. For 42 years in corporate America, I was the first African American to have every job that I ever had. So I've been fortunate. I've worked exceedingly hard. I've had a mate that was extremely supportive. I've had a company that recognized my talent, my skills, and placed me properly. And so that's where I place it.
We're talking to Roy Roberts. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Roy Roberts. Roy, as long as I've known you, you've never been bitter. Why not?
Well, I've been very fortunate. I'm blessed that the good Lord put me on this earth to have a father that mentored us and had us grow to think right and think properly, instill values in us. And you know, Jack, if you go through life and you're bitter, then you become the prisoner. I'm not a prisoner. I have lived really well. I continue to live well. I've got four kids who have all done well, have been to college. I've got five grand boys. One completed college. One will complete college next semester. One's a junior at my alma mater, and then two youngsters. God has blessed me. I am really blessed. And if I didn't say that, I'd be an ungrateful man. So there's a reason for me to be bitter about anything. I've had a lot of help from a lot of people, and I've done well by my standards.
Recently, I heard Susan St. James, who lost a 12-year-old son a year ago, she said, having bitterness is like you taking poison in the hope that the other person dies.
I think that's a great, great saying. And, you know, my goal in life is not for anyone else to ever be hurt. It's for me to do the very best I can, to be the best human being I can be, to be the best citizen I can be, and be a contributing member of society.
All of us are looking for self-respect. We want self-respect. We want a good self-image. For those of us that don't have it, Roy, how do we get it?
Well, you know, it's kind of like wisdom. Wisdom is a great thing to have, but you pay to get there. And people who don't have self-respect, who don't have a good feeling about who they are and what they are, I'm going to suggest to you they are the most dangerous people in the world. And a lot of us in the large community need to understand that. So when I see, for the sake of this conversation, a young African-American male who's trying to identify with Africa or where he's come from, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. Because if you don't have roots, if you don't believe in something, if you don't have that self-respect, you're like a balloon in a hurricane. You're anywhere and you're everywhere, and that's not a good thing. I think when you respect yourself, you don't do that at the demise of other people or at the expense of other people. You do it, and it will help you respect other people. Because if you can't respect yourself, how can you start to respect other people? I think it's critically important. So how does it start? It started with my father, making sure that I had that respect, making sure that I could respect other people, making sure that I could do the right thing by other people. And then that becomes a permanent part of your life. It became my moral compass as I went through life. And the same thing that happened in my professional life happened in my personal life, and the same principles carried over.
Speaking of self-respect, you're the past president of the Boy Scouts of America. Can you talk about the Boy Scouts of America?
Jack, I was not a scout. When I was a youngster, I walked past a scout troop one night, and I saw the great uniforms they had, and I simply assumed that we could not afford one, and I wouldn't ask the question. When I was 21 years old, a scoutmaster in Grand Rapids, Michigan, asked me to speak to a group of scouts. I did. I was so impressed with the young people that I haven't been involved ever since, 40-plus years with scouting. And I went up on the national board, and I served as head of the Jamboree in 97. And then I was vice president of scouting, executive vice president of scouting, headed up strategic planning. Then it was my turn in the barrel. I became president. It was one of the hardest jobs I've ever done because I did about 75 speaking engagements the first year and a half, and you pay for all your travel and everything that you do, but it's one of the greatest things that I've ever done because that organization is about instilling values in young people. It's about teaching them to plan and to think and do things. And the prior question you asked me about getting this instilled, if you look at a scout, that's where it comes from. If you show me an Eagle Scout, I'll show you a family. If you think about 53% of all the senators and congressmen were scouts, 80% of all the astronauts were scouts, and the businessmen galore, and I don't mean the bad ones, if they were scouts, they probably wouldn't be bad ones. They'd probably have a better value system. I'm telling you, this is a great organization, and it's well and alive today. They got over 5 million scouts, 3 million volunteers. They're doing very, very well.
Today, you're the managing partner of Reliant Equity Investors. This is a private equity firm. I don't think we had any private equity firms in Muskegon. We sure didn't have any private equity firms on the south side of Chicago. What is a private equity firm?
Well, Jack, they didn't have any when I was growing up either, believe me. And I learned about it late in my career. But a private equity firm is a firm that has private equity or money to invest. And normally you will get that money from pension funds, very patient money, or corporations, as we did. We got it from corporation pension funds across this country. CalPERS, CalSTRS, General Motors, SBC, Wells Fargo, great companies that decided to, they believed in our strategy. They believed in me and my partners, and they thought we could go out and invest this money in companies, grow the companies, sell them or take them public, and make a profit, and thereby give them more money back to put in their pension fund and take care of their retirees. That's what pension funds do, and that's what venture capital people are all about. So we go out and buy companies. And we looked at 1,300 companies last year to buy two. So it's a very arduous process, but we got some very, very bright and capable people.
Talk about the two you bought.
Well, we bought two last year and two the year before. So we have four portfolio companies. We have one as an automotive supplier that's doing okay because we're in a part of the business that we feel good about and our customers feel good about us. We have a company that we have a logistics company that haul from Indianapolis. From the Midwest, really, they're located in Indianapolis, down to Mexico. And we got about 180 trucks that we own with drivers. And then we also go to the outside and rent trucks and drivers. We have a company in New York, in Boston, that sell via internet and by magazines. We have a company in northern Indiana that's in the spinning business, a technology that I had never heard about in my life, but it's quite like a glass blower standing on a big trampoline. But he's actually shaping metal. And they're used for fuselages, for aircraft, and for big air conditioning units. And so we feel good about our portfolio companies, really good. Jack, we have 11 people in the firm, some of the brightest young people I have ever met in my life, and all committed and dedicated to making a difference.
One firm you said was an automotive firm, manufacturer, that's doing good. That's an oxymoron today. What do you know that we all don't know?
Well, I don't know if I know anything that they don't know. And really, in some cases, and I want to be careful here, those people that fail are on the margin. There are a lot of people out there that are doing very well at this business. But, you know, if the OEMs are making 1% or 2% return on their investment, then you got to expect the suppliers to catch a lot of heck, too. We're not making any big money. We are not making big money. But if you look at the history of the industry, the people who really made money for years, generations, were the supplier community and the dealer body. And the OEMs made the smaller portion of it. And so you're seeing some things get restructured in that regard. And I think you'll continue to see some restructuring in that regard. But I think the suppliers that are going to make money are the smartest people. I think the OEMs that are going to make money are the smartest people. I think jobs are going to gravitate to the smartest people in the world, and the people who are losers are going to be losers.
We're talking to Roy Roberts, and when we come back, we'll ask him about finishing well. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're talking to the past president of the Boy Scouts of America, Roy Roberts. Roy, finishing well. Why do you always continue to try to do the right thing?
Well, I think it's a critical part of my being. I don't think it's a horse that just start fast that win the race. It's a horse that will run hard throughout the entire race. And I always felt that I never had the right to do things wrong. I had lots of visibility, and I really felt that if I did things right, it would get amplified, and that could serve people well and break down a lot of myths between people. But I also felt that if I did things wrong, that could instill some myths that I didn't want to be a part of. So I felt that, and it was self-imposed, that I had a responsibility to do it right and make it better for mankind. And that's been a driver with me, Jack. Jack, you know, you know, I think of myself, Roy Roberts, and I think my father told me, the most important day of your life will be the day that you retire. If you can look in the mirror and you can say I did it right, then it's probably okay. And shortly after that, I saw a poem that, if you'd allow me, I'd like to share.
Please.
You got it from your father. It was all he had to give. So it's yours to use and cherish for as long as you may live. If you lose the watch they gave you, it can always be replaced, but a black mark on your name, son, can never be erased. It was clean the day you took it, and a worthy name to bear. When you took it from your father, there was no dishonor there. So make sure you guide it wisely. After all it's said and done, you will be glad the name is spotless when you give it to your son. That's a powerful piece, and when I pass it on to my four kids and my five grandsons, I want to make sure that they can respect the name of Roy S. Roberts, and they can respect their names and who they are and their responsibility to mankind as we move forward, for what it's worth. Our grandkids, we have them write a white paper when they are juniors in high school, and they have to tell us what it is they want to accomplish in life and the contribution they want to make to mankind. And if we like it, we'll send them to any college in the United States of America. We'll pay for them to get an undergrad degree. But it provides an opportunity for us to talk with them, to instill values in them, and to make sure that they understand what this life's all about. And so I really feel good about that. And it's a perpetuation of the name. It's a perpetuation of excellence that I want everybody in this family or my family to believe in, because that's what my father instilled in me.
Speaking of the future, Roy, what's the future of the big three, GM, Ford, Chrysler?
I think it's a bright future. I think the business model going forward will not be what it is today. And I don't purport to speak for General Motors, Ford, or Chrysler or anyone. I'm Roy Roberts, citizen. I believe that General Motors will be a different company going forward. I think they could potentially lose some market share in the process. I think they will be a stronger company going forward. I think they will be global in nature, much more global than they are today. But if you look at what happened this past year, they manufactured and sold more cars outside the United States than in the United States. They also made more money in China than they did in any other country on the face of this earth. So that speaks volumes about what's going on. I think the automotive writers have been unfair to the automobile industry here. They can look at a Ford or General Motors car and say some negative things about it, but if it was Japanese, they wouldn't say a thing. And it was like they were making their own reputation while they were doing that. I think that has to change. When I go to a dentist, and I know they made all their money off these automobile companies, and they tell me about this Mercedes they got in their garage, I tell them one thing. I believe the German engineer is better than the American engineer, and I believe the dentist in Germany went to a better school than you went to. I'm going to find me a German dentist. Then they tend to understand. It's a pocketbook that really makes a difference. And I don't believe that people ought to buy our cars just because we're American. They ought to buy it because we're doing a job. And these companies are doing a job. And I speak specifically of General Motors now. I know the quality, reliability, and durability of the cars are second to none, or absolutely second to none. And there are people who really don't want to believe that. But I think it's going to turn. So I think there's a great future. The future will not be like the past. It will be different. It'll take a different shape. But I think these companies will survive. And not only survive, I think they'll persevere.
The union workers, if one came up to you and said, Mr. Roberts, we were promised this. We've worked for this. I've been with this company 20, 25 years. You used to be the VP of Personnel and Administration. You promised it to us. We're entitled to it. What do you say to them?
I think that's the big misnomer, entitlement. And I think that really have hurt a lot of people. People did feel that it was an entitlement. I think they're not just from these automobile companies, but in this country, they think there's an entitlement. There's no such animal. No company can guarantee you anything without a guaranteed customer. If you can't sell it, you can't guarantee people a thing. And I think what happened, and my benefits have been changed, we said at the time, under these conditions, under X, we will do Y. And that's the way it's always been. So no laws have been violated or anything. But now the companies are in a position where they cannot afford it. If you look at what's happening with health care, galloping costs. If you pay more for health care than you do for steel, unbelievable. If you look at what's happening with pensions, and I'm one of those retirees out here, that's a big, big pill. And, you know, for I sit out here as a neophyte. If our companies, if General Motors moved more outside of here, nobody will incentivize them. No country will. No state will. But when people come to this country, they do get incentivized. But if you moved out and you hired the youngest and the brightest and the healthiest and had no legacy costs, it could probably help you pay off some of the legacy costs back here. So there's a lot to learn here. We'll see what transpires going forward. But I'm sitting on the sidelines doing the best I can, and I got 11 people in my firm that hope that I make the very best decisions that I can make and keep them going in the right direction.
The same union worker says, Mr. Roberts, Delphi, it's got these 80 key guys, 100 key people, and they're giving them bonuses to come and stay. They're making more, they make as much money as Tiger Woods makes on a putt. That's wrong. Why?
Well, if you look at it superficially, one would have to say, how can you take a company that has not done well and you file Chapter 11, the top executives get a bonus, and everybody else take a pay cut? That's on the surface. But the other option is, why don't you just let this company sink and don't do anything for anybody? You need those executives so bad it's unreal. And don't believe for one minute that most of those executives can't go out and get a job tomorrow in another company, in a competing company. And they could let Delphi just go right down the drain. And everybody at Delphi would lose everything. You need those people to stay around to try to turn this thing around and try and make it better. So I understand why they did it. I understand how they did it. And I say it's the right thing to do. And I don't think you've ever seen a company that went into Chapter 11 that didn't do the same thing for their top executives if you wanted to keep them around. You had to incentivize them to stay around because they don't have to stay.
Is the American dream still alive? Can somebody do what you did?
I think people can do what I did and do more than I did. A little example, and race is not just a total issue here, but the first three officers of the Big Three, they were all lawyers. They were all hired from the outside to come in because they were all trying to do something. Lately, you got to meet five officers at General Motors, African Americans, who all grew up in the system. You see that at Ford. You see some of that at Daimler Chrysler. So the system is working. And these people are brighter than I am. These people have the opportunity to go right past me. And some young people who haven't even entered the workforce are even brighter yet, and they can go beyond that because corporate America is starting to understand you can't solve all these problems without using all the skills that are available to you.
What advice would you give to young people today?
Mine tend to always gravitate back to education. You've got to get the very best education that you can get in the world because you're competing with the world, not just people in Detroit or people in Lansing over in Ohio. You're competing with the world. And we don't graduate enough engineers compared to India and China and other places. We've got to get about math and science as a nation and really educate our young people to compete in this global economy.
What role has faith played in your life?
Well, that's a moral compass. I have a minister, Reverend Charles Adams, who's one of the finest in the world. I'm a deacon at that church, and I've known all of my life that, Roy, you don't get this done by yourself. It's a man up above, and how you lean on him, and which tends to permeate how I run my professional life. It's been very central to everything that I do, and it's central to everything I do going forward.
Roy, what are you the proudest of?
Well, I'm awfully proud of my children and my grandchildren. And I think my wife and I, Maureen, I'm really proud of her. She's just a real trooper and a great supporter. But today we spend more time on our grandkids because we don't think we can shape our kids much at their age. We think we can have a great impact on our grandkids. And we spend a lot of time on that. I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the time I spent at General Motors. I'm proud of the great people that I worked with there.
Roy, thanks very much for sharing your amazing, inspiring story. Our guest next Sunday will be the executive director of the Super Bowl 40 host committee, Susan Scheer. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week because anything is possible. Spoken.